Welcome to our new show, Managing Software Development. In this show, we will be exploring the best practices, processes, tools, and philosophy of management. In this show, we will be speaking to dev managers, directors, senior leaders of the industry, and finding out how they manage large-scale, complex software projects. This show is not only for managers, but for anybody who aspires to be a manager. I'm glad that I'm starting this show with Eric Brechner. He is a longtime Microsoft veteran and a manager. And he is a special manager because he trained many managers of Microsoft. He is an author, he is a thought leader, presenter, and a mentor. His book, Hard Code, is one of the best-selling books on Amazon. If you will search internet, you will find many presentations of Eric talking about Kanban. So Eric, I saw one of your talk on Google, on Kanban, and I know you started coding at the age of 15.
That's right.
And so tell me how you get started in software and how long you've been in Microsoft and what you do here.
So like you said, I started when I was 15 years old. The TRS-80, Trash 80, as we used to call it, for Radio Shack. Just some typical nerdy kind of thing. Just some friends had one. Was playing around with it, playground with BASIC and Assembler and all that sort of thing. Ended up getting a job in New York City for an international bank, writing their banking software, which is a weird thing to do when you're 15 years old. But nonetheless, there weren't that many programmers at that time.
So you got a job at 15?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And in New York City.
At an international bank.
I kid you not. Millions of dollars of transactions just running through my software reports.
Wow.
I didn't know what I was doing. But that's just kind of how it was back then. There weren't that many people who knew how to program. And so I worked that job for a couple summers, and then taught at a computer day camp, and worked for a bunch of other companies, particularly during the summer. And really had an interest in computer graphics, so I worked at JPL's computer graphics lab with Jim Blinn. There were three of us at the time. Jim was the big star of the show. He did all the animations for the Voyager spacecraft going out to Saturn and Uranus and Neptune and all that, which I'd seen on TV, so it was really cool to be working with them. So I worked there for a summer and ended up working for Silicon Graphics, which was one of the major producers of computer graphics, specialized computers, for years. Anyway, I worked for them pretty early on in their development, and then eventually graduated college and worked for Boeing because I wanted to move to Seattle. Seattle's beautiful. I love Seattle. So I ended up back here. And couldn't get a job at Microsoft because I had an advanced degree, and Microsoft wasn't interested in people with advanced degrees at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up at Boeing for 5 years. And then eventually I had enough friends at Microsoft that they convinced me to come over. So I've been at Microsoft since 1995, so that's 22 years now.
22 years. And you worked on many places?
Oh yeah, all over the place. I started out in the research group and in what's called the Advanced Technology Group, which is kind of applied research.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago. And then moved into DevDiv, doing image editing software. And then from that, moved into Office, doing all of their content, clip art, photographs, animation, stuff like that, for the Office products. And then, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember all the different places I've gone. There's a lot. I was in engineering excellence for a while, and that's where I was training development managers and development leads, as well as architects. I ended up running that learning and development organization for the company for a while, and then went to Xbox and now Windows.
Oh, very good. So before I joined Microsoft, I used to be always intrigued by how Microsoft manages these complex projects. And these projects are not only complex, but they are dependent on other complex products. And there's this chain of complexity goes on of dependencies. And as a dev manager, you are in the center of all this complexity.
Yes.
And you are like conductor of the orchestra. So I wonder...
It's a conductor of a bunch of competing orchestras.
Competing orchestras.
And yet they have to make beautiful music together.
Beautiful music, yeah. That's so true. Yeah, you explained it very well, especially the Microsoft.
It's quite a thing.
Yeah. So what are the three most important responsibilities you think a manager has?
My goodness. So there's leads, right, who directly manage individual contributors, you know, individual engineers. And then, of course, there's group managers like myself who manage leads. There's directors. I used to be a director, you know, manages group managers and so on. So there's a whole hierarchy. For managers in general, what I used to tell new leads and new managers, there's just two things that matter. You talk a lot about complexity and all that sort of thing,
right.
But you're not going to be the one who deals with that directly, right? You're the individual contributors on your team and the leads secondary to them. They're going to be dealing with that complexity up close and personal. They're going to know all those details. You need to understand it at a high level, mm-hmm. but they're the ones who are doing the actual work. I never imagined myself as being the person who's doing the work. I'm
sure.
not. It's my individual contributors and my leads.
Mm-hmm.
So, for all those individuals, the most important thing to do is to ensure that they can do work.
Right.
Right. So, it's the basics, just that they have a computer, they have a desk, the air conditioning is working, they have networking. I know this sounds silly, but there's a lot of instances in which engineers just can't do their work because the networking's out, or they're a new employee and they don't have permissions, or, just the power's out or something like that. You know, these are things that are just fundamental. And that's so simple, just to make sure that your team can do work. The things that are subtle about them doing work is a friendly work environment. It's not hostile. There's no harassment. There's no feeling questionable about what I'm doing. Is it okay? Is it the right thing to do? Nothing like that, and feeling trusted, it's safe. It's safe for me to work here. I don't have to worry about, am I doing the wrong thing? Am I going to make someone upset? I can't tell the truth at work.
Right.
All those things keep me from doing my work. So the most fundamental thing for a manager is just people can do their work, and they know what work to do.
True.
Right? True. And then the second most important thing as a manager is just to care about your people. You have to care about them. If you don't care about them, they can tell. And if your manager doesn't care about you, you're not going to do your best. So what I used to tell leads and managers is, if you enable your people to work in a safe environment and you care about them, you're going to be a better than average manager. Mm-hmm. You're going to be a manager that your employees like. Your employees are going to get things done. They're going to enjoy doing them, and they're going to like you and working for you, and that's going to give you a better than average team, and you're going to be a good manager.
Mm.
It's just that simple. There's really nothing else to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so looks like what is the most important quality of a manager comes across is like he should have empathy with the team.
Absolutely.
And care about the people.
Yeah.
It's more about the people than the technology, you are saying.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I've worked on a lot of different technologies, managed a lot of different teams, doing a lot of different things around the company over the years, and then back at Boeing as well. And,
right.
You know, it's all about the people. You know, computer programming, you don't make buildings.
True.
Yeah, we do a fair amount of hardware work at Microsoft, so some people are building actual physical devices, but I'm a software manager,
right.
And it's all up in your head, it's all it's all like that. So the people are the only thing that matter,
True.
And they have to feel good about what they're doing. They have to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. They have to be able to do it. And then you caring about them makes them feel like they are going to get. And you caring about them, that enables them to feel good about what they're doing.
Right, and everything's taken care of by that one fact itself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you set vision, goal, and limits for your team?
So once you care about them, once you know, they can do their jobs,
right.
They you know obviously they want to be aligned with what all those other groups are doing.
Right.
Like you say, you're orchestrating. Yeah, these competing orchestras. You know, they need to be aligned. And so, of course, you want to have goals for your team that are aligned to what the overall division is doing. In my case, Windows is doing. But it would have been Office or Xbox in the past, previous groups. And setting those goals comes down to just understanding how the business works. We're in a business.
Mm-hmm.
We have customers. We want to keep our customers happy. We want to have them reach their potential.
Right.
That's what we do here at Microsoft.
True.
And you need to understand where your team fits into that business. You know, how do we make money? How do we make customers happy? So that they continue to pay us for the services that they think are of value to them, that they're willing to spend that money. What is the business strategy? And as a manager, you need to understand that.
Right.
And understanding is usually not terribly complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Our upper management is reasonably good at sending out regular mails and having meetings and giving talks and presentations. A lot of people blow those things off. They don't go. They don't listen, they don't read,
right.
And so of course, they're not going to understand how the business works.
Right.
But you put in the minimum effort to just listen to particularly what your top executives in your organization have to say,
right.
What they're trying to accomplish, it's not hard to think that, okay, how does what my team is doing, what my group is doing,
mm-hmm.
how does that fit in?
Right.
And that sets your goals.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helps you with your priorities.
Right.
And then in terms of limits, those are all about safety. Letting your team know what is out of bounds and where, if they're within bounds, like they're doing their code reviews,
right?
And you have more than one person on the code review, of course, right? And that they're doing the unit testing, and it's in line with the priorities, all that sort of thing. Just setting the appropriate limits for your team. Defining what done means, so important. You put those limits in place, and now your employees know, the engineers on your team know, that if they stay within those limits, they're safe.
True.
You're going to stand up for them, you're going to provide them air cover from anyone saying, hey, you're doing the wrong thing, or you're doing it the wrong way. As long as they stay within those bounds, they know that you're going to stand up for them.
Right.
And what they're doing is good.
Right.
So put those things together and your team knows what to do.
Okay. And the vision, so you talked about goals and the limits, but the vision is not set at your level in your team, but the vision is a broader, the group level vision. That's the vision you take, or you have a separate vision defined for your team?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both when it comes to visions. So. Mm-hmm. The vision for Microsoft is every individual, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it memorized, but every individual on the in the world can reach their full potential.
Yes.
That's what we would like to do. And so what does that mean for Windows? Well, it means for Windows that we want that to be true from people using the Windows operating system and the Windows family of devices.
Right.
And okay, so for my team, my team happens to provide a lot of the engineering systems that the engineers within Windows use to create those experiences for our customers. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to help every engineer in Windows reach their potential, be productive, deliver great experiences easily, for our customers, to help our customers reach their potential. That's a little wordy. You can show that. That's basically the vision for our team. So it's just, it's very much in line with the vision for the company, the vision for the division, and so on, but scoped to what we do.
What you do. And you have a formal process where you meet as a team maybe and say, here's our vision and here's our goals and these are the limits. So you do that kind of process. You go with the team.
Yeah, exactly. I have about a 3-4 slide deck.
Right.
That's welcome to, you know, my team.
Yes.
And in that slide deck, you know, the very first slide is, here's our vision and mission.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty similar to what I described.
Sure. Yeah,
edited down. nice English. And then, so that's our mission. Then our priorities, which are all about serving our customers.
Mm-hmm.
Very customer-obsessed organization.
Right.
And then the expectations, the limits that we have, which is, you know, just a handful of bullet items about when to be at work so that you can collaborate with other people. We want to have a lot of flexibility in people's schedules. I mean, people have interesting lines. Some people wake up early. Some people stay up late. You know, some people have obligations during the day. Whatever it might be, people need some flexibility. So when should you be here? I want to know bad news early so that we can do something about it. So that's another expectation that I have. Loving our customers and our partners, even when they're annoying and difficult and want the wrong things and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, those are the expectations that I have for the team. And you just lay those out and then you're good.
Right. So, Eric, what are the best practices of engineering you use?
Oh, gosh. So, again, I want to emphasize that just caring about your people and making sure that they can work. Mm-hmm. So they know what to do, they know what's safe to do, they have a good work environment. That matters the most. I just want to emphasize that because when I start talking about agile practices and Kanban and all these other great things that I like to use on my teams, I don't want to overemphasize there. Your team can be very successful working a wide variety of ways if you care about your people, if they know what to do and they're able to do it. You've made them able to do it. That said, I do adore Kanban, mm-hmm. which is why I wrote a book about it.
True.
And gave presentations at Amazon and Google and Microsoft and a number of those you can find on the internet. But what's wonderful about Kanban is that it's tough to coordinate a team,
mm-hmm.
and have them stay focused and organized and execute on the project at hand. And I've used a lot of different methods over the years. I enjoy experimenting with it. I'm very interested in it. It's just kind of a hobby.
And you must have started in Boeing with completely waterfall.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Boeing was pretty waterfall. When I first came to Microsoft, it was very waterfall.
Yeah.
And waterfall in the traditional waterfall sense, not in the formal sense of how it was originally written up, but in the sense that people practiced it. And I would try all kinds of variations on waterfall to have that be more efficient. And at the end of the day, there's just a lot of work that's thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of work that you think you know what you're doing, and later on it turns out it wasn't quite right. And so you have to redo it.
Right.
Or it has a lot of bugs, and you have to fix those, whatever it might be. And then there's a whole bunch of overhead in terms of writing specs, writing up detailed design documents, doing estimation, all these activities. But at the end of the day, if you could get away with not doing them,
right.
none of them ship to the product.
True.
None of them are customer value.
Right.
And all the work that you throw away is not customer value. All the work that you redo the first time you did it was not customer value. The redone work is the customer value. Not that every time you have to fix a bug, right? That's not adding customer value. It's kind of fixing something that should have been there in the first place.
True.
So all these things are subtracting away from the time at the end of the project you wish you had.
Right.
Right? Oh my gosh, if we could get that time back. What a difference it would make. So, I've just been seeking for a long time practices that remove a lot of the stuff that doesn't seem to add value,
mm-hmm.
and allows a team to focus purely on adding that customer value and not having to do rework, getting things right the first time as much as reasonable.
Cool.
And Kanban has been it for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I tried Scrum for a good 8 years, mm-hmm. Got very good at it. I like Scrum a lot, much better than traditional waterfall. But Scrum had a whole bunch of meetings and a whole bunch of documentation that it created,
right.
A whole bunch of estimation, things like that, that were going on, that none of those activities were directly related to customer value. And Kanban has almost no overhead associated with it. And as a result, the team stays organized, because it does have structure.
True.
The team stays organized, works in priority order as they need to, can estimate and predict when their work will be done, you know, when asked.
Right.
So at any time they can provide those estimates. But requires almost no overhead work.
Right.
So all the time is spent talking about the product, adding value to the product.
Right.
And it also has guidelines that help you produce high quality every step of the way, which means there's far fewer bugs and far less rework.
Right. So in Kanban, you said you can provide the estimate for sure. Because you have the list of, you know, all the work items and your backlog as such. But on day to day, you prefer not to do the estimation, or you do the estimation? Because what I understand is you have a backlog queue. As soon as the dev is done, you will come and pick up the next item, and the queue will keep moving.
That's right. Yeah, Kanban is a continuous value delivery system.
Right.
That's kind of fancy words for it.
Sure.
But it's basically just, you're just continuously working. You
right.
don't stop for artificial time, you know, time box sprints or anything like that. You're
right.
just working. And so it just flows through. So no, I don't ask my engineers for estimates.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, of course, my management will ask for estimates.
Yes,
our
partner
teams will.
That.
Of course they will.
Yes.
They will ask for estimates. They want to plan.
Right.
They want to understand where things are at. And they have every right to that information. It's very
right.
helpful to them. So so I'm happy to provide that information. I'm happy to have my team provide that information when it's asked for.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not asked for, my customers don't care
yes.
what the estimate was. They care about receiving the product and the product being high quality and the product solving their problems and helping them achieve more in their lives.
Right.
That's what they care about. They don't care about the estimate.
Right.
So producing the estimates when they're unnecessary, that's a waste of time.
True.
Producing the estimates for people who need them, that's valuable.
Right.
Kanban makes it very easy to provide those estimates.
True.
You just count how many things you've finished in a given week. That's how quickly you finish stuff, and then you count how many items you have to finish before the item that people are expecting,
right.
and you can tell exactly how long it's going to take for them to get it. So it's very straightforward to do that estimation. Everything's very visible in Kanban.
Right.
But I don't have my folks do it.
Because I've been through teams where people have a lot of resistance saying, why are you estimating when we are in Kanban? And I'm saying, that's not true, that if you will not have an estimation if you are in Kanban, because at the end of the day, at some level, we have to know the dates, and for sure it can trickle down, and we don't have to measure day-to-day progress and every hour progress as such.
Exactly right. Yeah, and so we just do it on demand. We're not going to do it for everything, because not everything people need estimates for.
True.
But for the things that people do need estimates for, we're happy to provide the estimate.
Okay. So my next question is, what practices you will not compromise on, and what practices you will be flexible on? Do you have some rules?
That's great. I am not flexible. People have to have rules for when they're done.
Yes.
I'm not flexible on that. If you want to use Scrum, use Scrum. If you want to use Kanban. If you want to use traditional waterfall, use traditional waterfall. It's all good to me.
True.
My preference, of course, is Kanban, and my teams use Kanban because they love it.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone felt strongly about Scrum or whatever, it's great.
Right.
but you must have rules for being done. It's not okay to have some engineers on your team say they're done with something and do a slight, a shoddy job.
Right.
And affect everyone else on the team with their shoddy work.
Right.
And have the stronger engineers on the team do a quality job and end up, and their reward for doing a quality job is fixing the terrible person's work.
Right.
That's awful. You can't claim that you're finished with something on any of my teams without it meeting that quality bar.
So what is the done definition in your team? Like we have done, often people say, but when you say no, code review is still going on. You're not done yet.
Exactly, that's right.
So do you have a definition of done?
Yeah, so we have, because we're using Kanban, there's done at every step.
Right.
So we have definitions for each one of those. But those definitions are very basic. Again, not trying to waste people's time. We want to be focused on customer value. So like the done for the breakdown or specking step is nothing more than we have it broken down into tasks that only take, few days, and people understand what to do.
True.
Simple as that. There doesn't have to be a document. Often a document is helpful, or it could just be a whiteboard drawing or whatever. But it can also just be, make it like this other thing.
True.
As long as people understand what to do and it's broken down, we're good. For the code itself, code reviewed, unit tested, the usual kinds of things, right? It builds, compiles, it passes the basic test. That's for that step. For validation, we've put it into a production environment and it works properly. We have every expectation that it functions. And then done is in the customer's hands.
Okay.
It is deployed. We're done.
We're done.
Now, deployed means different things for different stuff.
True.
Right. So deployed for code that's going to Windows means it's gotten out of our branch into main other or into our partner's branch, wherever it was supposed to go, it's gotten there.
Right.
Okay, that's done for that. If it's a web service, done means it's out in production. It's been deployed. If it's an app or something like that, that could mean it's in the store. Or it's in whichever environment, maybe it's not supposed to be in the store yet, it's for internal testing, but it's in the hands of the people that need it.
Right. Okay. So now let's change a little bit gear of coming out of processes to people. How you manage, big egos or highly competitive people and very intelligent people here, right? In Microsoft, you can get a combination of all three sometimes.
Absolutely.
So how do you deal with them?
So there's not that much that I care about, and I put it all on that, we talked earlier about our expectations, limits.
Right.
They're all on that slide. We win as a team is one of those. Loving our customers and partners is one of those.
Right.
Being around during certain hours of the day so people can collaborate is one of those. But there's very few items on that list.
Right.
Winning as a team is absolutely critical to me, as much as loving our customers and partners.
Cool.
And so if someone is super bright and and they're quite opinionated, that's fine. That's fine as long as they win together as a team. It's not about them. It's about the team. As long as they put the team first, as long as they treat our customers and our partners with respect, as long as they care about our customers the way you care about family. Family can be difficult.
True.
Right? Family can be demanding. Family can be even annoying at times.
Right.
But you love them. They're your family. They're the only people you got. And customers, our partners, they're the only reason why we're here.
Yes.
There's no other purpose to our work than to serve them.
Right.
And so it's important for those people to have that. So if I've got an outspoken, potentially difficult person, but they put the team first, they have their, each other's backs on that team, right? They cover for each other. Don't throw anyone under the bus, right? You know, they're a team and they work together as a team. And that person cares about our customers and partners. We're good. We're good. Yeah, they're a little difficult. Everyone's a little difficult. Everyone's a package deal.
True.
Right? Everyone's got their good sides and bad sides, myself included.
True.
Right?
True.
You know, that's, it's humans.
Yes.
So that's fine. Now, of course, there's going to be super talented people who don't work well on the team, who are particularly arrogant, difficult with customers. They're in front of a customer and they'll contradict other people on the team, on their own team. They'll give opinions that are outside of what we agree to as a group, and give those to customers and make customers question the quality and value of the services that we're providing.
Cool.
You know, I have zero tolerance for those people. I don't care how smart they are. I don't care how talented they are. I don't care how much of the system that they've created. None of that matters if they can't be part of a team and take care of our customers and partners. They have no place on my team, and they can work somewhere else, and they do.
So I think you gave a lot of hints, but still I'll ask this question on how do you hire, and what is the secret to get hired in Microsoft? Also, you can talk about, because you've been to many different groups, and every group has a kind of slightly different culture.
Sure, yeah, I agree.
So, what are the key things you look in a candidate while hiring?
So there's two different questions there.
Sure.
You know, what am I looking for? What do I think Microsoft is looking for? And then, of course, how do I actually go about finding such people and hiring them into the company? Microsoft looks for smart individuals who are passionate. So they're smart, they can code, right? They know how to do that. That's what we do around here. Obviously, there's also some electrical engineers and folks like that who do, you know, other jobs at the company. But when we're talking about software developers, they can code. And they're passionate. They love doing it.
Right.
They love coding, they love technology. They just want to contribute. And if you can do those things, if you're an engineer who can code and is passionate about it, there's a chair waiting for you at Microsoft. Or a standing desk, if you prefer. That's what I use. But, there's a job waiting for you here. We love bright people who can code and who care. For my own team, I also want someone who can work well on a team, and someone who shows that they can learn and grow. And I should have mentioned that with Microsoft as well. Microsoft wants people that are going to continue to grow and improve.
Right.
And I certainly look for that when I'm interviewing individuals. And that's it. I keep it very simple. I don't care that much if they know the specific technology that we're working on, because they'll pick it up in a few months.
Cool.
I don't care that much about whether or not they've done Kanban before, or Scrum before, or whatever. That's a nice plus,
right,
if they've done those kinds of things. But, that's not important to me. What's important to me is they can code, they're passionate about it, and they're willing to grow and improve over time.
Right.
And then for me, in particular, they work well on the team.
Right. Often here, we have to do a phone interviews for candidates.
Yeah.
And on the phone, you have to make a call whether we should fly him across the world sometime or across the, from the other cities. What questions you ask in the phone interview and how you judge just on phone that, this candidate can be good?
Yeah, it's really tricky.
Yeah.
Of course, it depends on the position, but if we're just talking about a software engineer,
right.
The questions, you're not going to get a real sense of a person on a phone. You can't.
True.
So really what you're trying to do with phone screens, as they're often called, is to filter, to just avoid people who aren't going to work out. Because you're not going to know exactly who will work out, but at least you can learn who won't work out.
Right.
And then that's what I focus on with phone screens. Mm-hmm. So typically the questions are going to be, what are the things that are just absolute must-haves that someone can find out objectively in a phone screen? So you can ask some basic coding questions in a phone screen that have straightforward answers for people who know how to code, but people who don't know how to code, they're going to have trouble with those.
True.
So I'm going to ask things like that. Some basic questions about, you know, projects that they've worked on, and the person doing the phone screen, which is often a recruiter, mm-hmm. Or, you know, a junior member of your team, or, you know, who knows.
Right.
But someone doing the phone screen can ask that question and listen to the person on the other end, and do they sound excited?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they don't sound excited about that, and that doesn't mean that they have to raise their voice and go, "Oh, I'm so excited." But, you know, it can also be just they go into incredible detail, or, you know, you can tell when someone's interested in something versus when someone's just whatever.
True.
And so, you know, given that what we care about is that they can code and they're passionate,
right,
and they're willing to grow, asking basic questions in those areas is sufficient to know whether or not they're worth talking to.
What's the worst advice you heard about management? I'll give you my example. One day somebody told me, when you will not have Visual Studio on your laptop, you will become a good manager. I said, really? Because that's very anti-Microsoft thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple of pieces of advice. I was giving good advice. I was fortunate. But there were a couple of things, both having to do with getting caught up in the details.
Hmm.
So one person was, you have to have super detailed plans, you know, for the entire next, you know, 12 months, 9 months, you know, down to a few days, all broken out in advance.
Hmm.
And that's silly. You know, at the time, I didn't know better. But that's silly. And then there was another manager I had who was just, you have to keep track of what people are doing all the time.
Mm.
You know, and if they're spending too much time talking on the phone, you know, with their wife or their girlfriend or their boyfriend or whoever, right, you know, that's bad.
Right.
You know, you have to look after those things. Again, terrible advice.
True.
You know, the reason why, you know, getting caught up in the details is terrible is that that's not your job.
Mm.
That's their job. It's your employees, the engineers who work for you.
Right.
They're doing the work. They know what work to do.
Mm.
Especially if you're given the general guidance of, you know, here are our goals and priorities, and, you know, here's the expectations that we have, the limits that we've set. They know what to do. And they know how best to do it.
Right.
You don't know all those details.
Right.
Even if they told you some of them, you know, and you could give them a little bit of advice here and there, that would be helpful.
Right.
They're the ones who are expert at it. They're the ones who are doing it. And telling them when they can talk to their, you know, their family members, or how much time they're spending at the water cooler or whatever, maybe, you know, that's silly, no one has water coolers anymore, but yeah,
yes.
How much time you're spending in the kitchen or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
You know, that's focused on the wrong things.
True.
You know, what I say to the engineers on my team, they take as a reflection of what I care about.
True.
If I talk about how much time they're spending on the phone, they think I care about how much time they spend on the phone.
Sure.
What do I care about that?
Yes.
If I talk about customers, if I talk about value, if I talk about making a difference in the lives of the people that we serve, that our products and services give and change people's lives,
right.
If I talk about that and how much that matters,
right.
And how exciting it is what we're working on,
mm-hmm.
And what a difference we can make, if I talk about that, well, then they walk around thinking that I'm doing something important, which they are.
True.
And what matters are our customers.
Customers, yeah. Right.
Yeah, and they, of course, are the only thing that.
So what is the best advice you heard about management?
You know, it was indirect.
Mm-hmm.
it was watching the managers that I liked the most as I was moving up. Mm-hmm. You know, I had examples of horrible managers, and I had some examples of managers I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And while none of them gave me specific advice about being a manager,
mm-hmm.
You know, there was differences between them, between how they carried themselves, between what they talked about, what they focused on. And that's, you know, when I realized that management is simple.
Right.
You know, it's made out to be this big whoop-de-doo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly plenty of complexity there.
True.
But to be a good manager is simple, because all the good managers I had, they didn't have a lot in common, but what they did have in common was I always knew where I stood with them. Mm-hmm. I knew what I was supposed to be doing.
True.
I was able to do it. You know, the things that would normally get in my way, they would remove. And they would make sure that I could work.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what to do. And that they genuinely care about me.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where that advice came from.
Came from.
Is right. that those were the things that they all had in common.
Right.
And it just wasn't that complicated. Because everything else, they did differently.
Right, right. So after listening to you, I also start feeling that, yeah, management seems like a very easy or cool job, not easy.
It is. It's a great job. It's not necessarily easy.
Not necessarily easy. Because as we talked about, we have very ambitious, intelligent people here.
Yes, we do.
And type A people mostly. And then there's often the conflict happens in the team.
Yes.
No matter, even if we all are going in the same direction, even there will be some conflict. How you resolve those conflicts between two people, and most probably both of them are right, and you will make a judgment call depending on your experience, because you've seen, you know, a lot of software happen, and often people come out of college, they read a few books, and they said, no, this is the right way to do it.
Yeah, I find that there's two things that matter in resolving those conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
One is something you can do in advance, because you want the resolution to be about the customer, about the product, about the business.
Right.
You don't want the resolution to be about the individual personalities and who's right and who's wrong. You want it to be about the customer, about the business. Those are the things that matter. So in preparation for that, one of the things that matters is not making comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to stay away from comparisons. This person's idea is better than that person's idea. Bad.
Right.
Let's talk about this idea. Let's talk about that idea. We're not going to compare.
Right.
We're not going to compare people. Oh, he's smarter. Oh, she's higher level. We're not going to do that.
Right.
We just talk about each individual aspect of the decision we're trying to make, not make comparisons. As soon as you're making comparisons, now it's a competition.
True.
So, and it's not a competition. So stay away from that.
Right.
And then the second piece is not about you providing your wisdom and, you know,
right,
resolution, but you making it safe for them to find the resolution themselves. And the way you make it safe is by talking about what is the problem.
Mm.
What are you truly trying to solve? Why do you feel that it should be one way and you feel it should be another?
True.
And then, you know, as they talk about it and as you describe it, again, not comparing, not saying one's better than the other, but really understanding. People are only passionate about things because they have a real sense of something that might be a problem, something that might be particularly elegant as a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, they have real thought behind what they're saying, regardless of level, regardless of how long they've been at the company, or whatever.
Right.
They have some thoughts in mind. Understand what those things are, bringing those out, talking about how whatever solution we come up with, whatever decision we make, it's going to be one that resolves the issues that are on the table for everybody,
cool,
right? And to the extent that, you know, we can't be perfect about it because you can't, you know, make it work perfectly for everybody, of course, that we're at least going to understand where each other are coming from, get all that on the table, and come up with a solution that works for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then it's amazing, you know, once people have their concerns out in the open, and they know that everyone's on the same page about resolving those concerns in a way, maybe it's not perfect, you know, maybe it's not exactly what I wanted when I walked in the door, but I can live with that.
Okay.
I can live with that. Then it's amazing how well people get along and can resolve, you know, their differences.
True. So what is the worst part of being a manager?
The worst part of being a manager? Yeah, I found layoffs particularly difficult. Doing layoffs is particularly difficult. More than disciplinary action. You know, with disciplinary action, the person involved, they know well in advance from me and from their own work that there's a problem. You know, there's just not a good fit here, and there's stuff that they need to do, and you know they feel okay. I'm not saying anyone's happy, of course, but they understand, especially if you're clear with them the entire way, you're honest with them, you're really hoping that they can improve, and you know, when they're struggling, you know, you acknowledge that and talk it through. Layoffs are a different matter. Layoffs have nothing to do with the individuals involved. It has to do with the company, you know, just making a business decision about where it wants to put its resources and what the company needs to, you know, what the company needs.
Right.
And, you know, and individuals get caught in a bad spot sometimes with that, where the work that they're doing is no longer needed by the company and they get laid off. It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens, and I've had to deal with it a few times over the course of my career. And that's very, very difficult because the individuals take it personally, because it is a personal thing for them. They're losing their job. And yet it's not personal.
True.
You know, they could be a wonderful employee.
Yeah.
That you would love to retain if you could,
right?
And that's, you know, that's I think the most difficult part of the job.
Okay, suggestions to a developer who wants to become a manager. What suggestions you will give them?
Yeah. So first, I would say mentor people. Being a manager is mostly about, you know, working with individuals on your team,
right,
helping them grow, helping guide them. And making them successful. I think of it very much, I believe very much in the, you know, I serve my team, right? So start doing that, you know, mentor an intern, you know, mentor the people on your team or on other teams. If you have a chance to be a tech lead or something like that, take on that role and, you know, work across teams, you know, work out difficult situations between partners, that sort of thing. And then, you know, that starts preparing you well. And, you know, when, and then of course, you want to let your manager know, your lead or your group manager know, that you would like to be a lead someday, or be a manager someday. And then, you know, with that experience, you know, chances are you'll get that opportunity.
Okay. How you manage your time, and if you look, your calendar, where you spend most of your time in a day?
If you look at my calendar in any particular week, the majority of the time are going to be in one-on-ones. I have weekly one-on-ones with my directs. We set aside an hour. We don't always use an hour, but we set aside an hour. And then I have monthly one-on-ones with everyone on my staff.
Okay.
And those are just for a half hour, and they're just once a month. Turns out that amount of time for the skip levels is about the same amount of time as for the weekly one-on-ones with my directs. So you put all that together, and you get what's the majority of my week. The rest of the time are spent in a variety of both recurring and one-off meetings. I don't have a lot of time that I have just as focused time, because that's not really the essence of a group manager job, a development manager job. Development manager job really serves, you know, his or her team.
True. Would you like to recommend any author or a book for managers? Your book,
of course,
I would recommend like Hard Code.
Of course, there's Hard Code, which has about two thirds of the columns that I've written. There's another third columns that haven't made it into a book yet, that are just published on the web for free. Mm-hmm. And of course, I write a lot about being a good manager and various aspects of it. In terms of books I'd recommend to people who want to be a manager, you know, there's just so many. There's so many books out there. I've read a number of them. Mm-hmm. There aren't any, honestly, that stand out. And I think the reason why there aren't that many that stand out, including my own, is that, you know, people, when I read these books, the same themes keep coming up over and over again. Mm-hmm. And there's all this detail and all these things you need to worry about, all these specific situations, the specific way of handling something, the specific way of talking about something, whatever it might be, in great detail. And you read the book and you're like, so much keep in your head, how am I ever going to get good at this? Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is the wrong way to think about it. You have to be true to yourself. You have to, you know, you have to bring integrity and your own voice to your job. If you seem like you're trying to be someone else, people see through that immediately.
True.
So, that's why I emphasize so much just about making sure people can do their job.
Right.
They know what to do. It's safe to do it. They have what they have the tools they need to do it, and caring about them, and the rest of it falls into place.
Right.
So there are a wide variety of books, both about software development, about people management, about handling difficult conversations. There, if you go on to, you know, Amazon or whatever other bookseller that you like, and you look at the recommendations, you know, highly rated management books are generally speaking going to be good and have a lot of similar messages to them. And my recommendation would more be, what is the particular situation that you're dealing with?
Right.
Is it a difficult conversation? There's a wonderful book, I think it's called Difficult Conversations. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic, right? Is it software development, and there's just a whole bunch of very specific things about software development that you're having trouble with? Well, there's a bunch of good books about managing software developers that talk about those specific situations.
Right.
If it's about hiring or firing, there are specific books that talk about those cases.
Sure.
So you can always, you know, read up on specifics. But as long as you care about your people and they can do their jobs, you're going to be in good shape.
Actually, you summarize it very well about the whole management philosophy about, like, the essence of everything is just the people.
Yeah.
It's just the people.
You're a manager. You're managing people. Yeah. You want them to do a great job. You want them to love their job. You want them to look forward to every day that they're coming to work for you.
Cool.
And the way that you do that is to understand who they are as human beings, as whole human beings, what makes them happy, what they care about, and serve that in them. And tie that to the great work that your team is doing.
Yeah.
And if you do that, they're going to be happy. They're going to be motivated. You're going to get great work out of them. You're going to get great work out of your team. And at the end of the day, that's your job.
True. Last question.
Yeah.
You are here in Microsoft for a long time. So what's so special about Microsoft?
I absolutely love Microsoft. I worked in a lot of places before Microsoft. I listed a few of them for you. I left a few of them out. What's special about Microsoft, there's a bunch of different things. One, the company gives a lot of autonomy to the people that work here. There's not a lot of top-down, this is how you have to do it sort of thing.
Yes.
And I love that. I love that freedom. I find it motivating to be able to set my own path. So that's wonderful. Another thing that's tremendous about Microsoft, of course, there are all the people that you work with, very talented folks.
Right.
It's unusual to find someone who isn't really capable at the company. And I've worked for places where the reverse is true. So that's wonderful. But that also describes some other software companies that also give a lot of control to an autonomy to their engineers. and also hire very smart people. I think what's special about Microsoft within that, you know, within that group of technical companies is that, you know, Microsoft sincerely cares about changing the world, making the world a better place, helping people achieve their potential. When you look at the business models of many of our competitors, those business models are about either helping out a particular niche, or they're about you know, making money through advertising, something like that, where their business model is not centered on their customers and enabling their customers to improve their lives. But and they may care about that, of course. You know, they're human beings running those companies, engineers working there. I'm sure they care about it, but their business model is about serving the people that are paying for their business, which are the advertisers. At Microsoft, the people paying for our business are the people buying our software. They are our customers. And so because it's set up that way, and because we have a lofty goal of changing the world, making the world a better place, and enabling everyone to reach their potential, and that's, like, you know, that permeates the company, because it's that way, and it's those same people that we're serving that are the ones who are paying us to do it, everyone here is just inspired to give our fellow human beings the best possible products, the best services. Of course, we don't always, you know, reach that lofty goal, but we try. Every meeting I go to, every conversation I have, every decision that I'm part of, it's focused on our actual customers. Are they having a better experience? Are we making a difference for them? Are we solving their problems? Are we making them more productive? Are they having better lives because of our products? That is so inspiring. And it just permeates the company, not just in the products and services that we deliver, but also in just how we behave toward each other at the company. And I love it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, with that, thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll meet again, because there's a lot of questions still remaining for me.
And oh, absolutely. I'll have you come back anytime.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. We'll see you guys next time.